Welcome. This is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Big thank you to Heart Thongs, the metaphysical energy thong, for supporting this episode of the DTFH. If you're having difficulty numbing down your heart, try a heart thong. They come in all shapes and sizes and are all made of dehydrated demon hides, guaranteed to keep you from feeling those pangs of compassion that really can ruin a person's day. Neither the DTFH or Duncan Trussell is responsible for any of the wild animal attacks that have been happening across the country. Now on with the show. Ah, my dear loves, my heart, it's all mushy today. It's all open, unexpectedly. Usually it like is sealed shut like an old crypt, an old cursed sarcophagus down in the bottom of some decrepit shit pyramid in a dark alien landscape in some horrible dream the old sailor is having as his ship begins to sink into a stinking, dead, briny sea filled with skeleton sailors mocking him as he breathes his last breaths. But today, I don't know. It just opened up unexpectedly. Somebody sent me a nice Instagram message about their dog they just lost. And then I started thinking about Fox and my Chihuahua, who I lost a few months ago. And then just a classic grief meteor smashing into the unprotected imaginary heart planet that I spend a lot of time trying to cover up in various metaphysical energetic forms, most of them metaphysical leather thongs. Did I just say that I wrap a metaphysical leather thong around my heart planet to keep myself from getting shaken up by grief meteors? Yes. Which is why you should consider using a metaphysical heart thong from Jerry's Heart Thongs. Go to jerryshartthongs.com, use offer code Duncan791, and you, in a dream, will have a metaphysical heart thong delivered to you by a mermaid in an ocean of cum. Today's guest is one of my best friends, and I'm so lucky to have him as a friend, because the truth is, this thing, whatever you want to call it, spirituality, trying to be a better person, self-transformation, almost every single way of describing the process of maybe not being such a festering boil on the carapace of reality sounds cheesy, but however you want to put it, part of the thing is you get confused. You're supposed to get confused. That's part of it. It is confusing. I mean, this is confusing. This thing that we're in right now, it's confusing. Think of all the forms you're going to have to fill out over the next however many years you're going to be alive. Literally, like probably a book, like a giant book of stupid forms you're going to have to fill out and sign. Various stupid forms. Forms to get into an overprotected dog park. Forms to get out of traffic tickets, weird forms when someone you love dies. One of the most humiliating things the demiurge tosses our way is that after you lose someone you love, you're going to be filling out fucking forms. You thought this was going to be some mystical time of beautiful morning? No, you're going to fill out 600 different forms. You're going to have to write, you're not going to have the right check for the undertaker. Form after form. The point is, it's confusing here. It's confusing. Human penises are shrinking because of pollution. There's just so much already happening just in the material level of this universe that it's gonna confuse you. Then add to that this weird idea of meditation or the possibility that you're not your body. And come on, it's bonkers beyond bonkers. And you're not supposed to go at it alone. You know, this is why there's classes and all these different things. Calculus, you want to learn to knit, you want to learn to solder. You're going to do better with someone around. And this identical thing is true when it comes to whatever you want to call this. For this thing, for me, it's like I just want to avoid as many embarrassing explosions of selfish anger as I can over the last half of my life. And so for me, that's why I need a spiritual community. And one member of that community is today's guest, Raghu Marcus, though membership is open to everyone and you all are members, even if you don't know it. The point is, it's like you need a palate cleanser. You need some kind of grounding mechanism. And for the type of personality that I have, this grounding mechanism, it's not going to happen in the presence of like somebody who, you know, a positivity fascist. You know, it's not going to happen in the presence of somebody who thinks that any emission of verbal dismay is a bad sign. You know what I'm talking about? The like spiritual hall monitors that if you, the moment you say something like, fuck this shitty bullshit fucking traffic, they'll be like, but the traffic teaches us. That shit. That's not going to work for me, though I feel like I've inflicted that on people I love in weak moments. The point is, it's nice to have people like Raghu who have this incredible authenticity that includes within it aspects that maybe you wouldn't say that's some Dalai Lama stuff there. But also within the authenticity and the reality that you will hear in this conversation, something else comes out, something beautiful and sweet and full of love. And the Ram Dass community has as a nexus this being that showed up called Neem Karoli Baba. This was Ram Dass's guru and Raghu's guru. And having met many people who actually met this person, it's interesting because you can kind of see this being's spirit in all of them. And I feel like anytime I get a chance to have the kind of conversation you're about to hear with Raghu, it's like I get a little... It's like a little brush with that person. And I need those kinds of brushes. I get emails from y'all. I got an email from somebody. Forgive me if I'm calling you out. I didn't ask permission. But I got this lovely email. I'll change the drugs. I got this lovely email from someone who was smoking Garvarius Melvanabex, this wild drug that is gathered from the pollen of cricket-infested tulips. And in that state of being super high that happens to last the exact same amount of time as DMT, he encountered Neem Karoli Baba. And just so that y'all know where I'm at, when I read a thing like that, I don't think, wow, that's really lovely. I think that's so wonderful. I think, what the fuck? Why don't I ever get that experience? That's just where I'm at. So I need it. I love it anytime I get just the slightest fragrance of this wonderful being that had one of his incarnations in India. And I think now is existing within the connection between people like Raghu and Ram Dass. And somehow in that connection, in that conversation, it's like it just appears. So enjoy this chat. If you like Raghu Marcus, you should check out his wonderful podcast, Mind Rolling. And you can also check out the Love, Serve, Remember Foundation's website, loveserveremember.org, because Raghu is tirelessly planning all kinds of wonderful things via that network and via the Ram Dass Foundation, the Love, Serve, Remember Foundation. So we're going to jump right into this conversation with Dear Raghu, but first, this. 828-579-9529. That's my Mint Mobile number, and I just want to thank Mint Mobile for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. Look, here's the thing. I don't advertise anything on this show that I don't use or like. And so I actually had to postpone a couple of Mint Mobile ads because I was moving and I didn't have a chance to test it out. But that number I just gave you, you can call me on my Mint Mobile phone. And you should know that having activated my phone with Mint Mobile, it worked perfectly, and it happened really fast. My expectation was it was going to be maybe a grubby website or some kind of lame interface or something that made me feel like I was being hornswoggled by oligarchs. But no, everything was flawless. It worked perfectly. And I tweeted the phone number and took a bunch of calls, and not a single one dropped out. They were all crystal clear. So this is a wonderful option if you're looking for extra savings. Mint Mobile offers premium wireless for just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and keep your same phone number along with all your existing contacts. And if you're not 100% satisfied, Mint Mobile has you covered with their 7-day money-back guarantee. Switch to Mint Mobile and get premium wireless service starting at just $15 a month. Friends, I'm using it and it works. It's not a dream. It's not some kind of thing cooked up by a pirate that lives in the mountains in some dark, war-torn land, but rather it's just a flawless, high-tech, awesome option for you if you're sick of getting vampirized by your current phone company. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/Duncan. That's mintmobile.com/Duncan. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/Duncan. Sorry about the fire trucks. Some wild dogs have been roaming through Asheville and have been attacking people. I got an email at lavenderhour@gmail.com from a listener who was recently attacked by a wild raccoon. At the time, she was not a Patreon subscriber. And I got to tell you, she sent some pictures, and this little fella ripped her up. There were deep gashes and terrible claw marks, and she had to get rabies shots. I'm not saying there's any connection between her not being a subscriber to patreon.com/DTFH and these wild animal attacks, because that would be almost like I was threatening my dear listeners or saying, you know, if you don't subscribe to the Patreon, there's probably a 80 to 90% chance of, especially this summer, the summer of blood, as they're calling it, of you getting attacked by a cute wild animal. Nothing larger than a raccoon, I would guess. I'm not sure because there's no connection. That's all I'm saying, is there's zero connection between these wild animal attacks that have been happening with great abundance and people who have yet to subscribe to patreon.com/DTFH. It is interesting, though, that the subscribers haven't been getting attacked. So that's curious to me, and I wonder what that means. Regardless, I hope you'll check it out at patreon.com/DTFH. Subscribe. You can join us every Monday for our weekly meditation, Journey into Boredom. And Friday, we have our wonderful family gathering. We have a active community of brilliant, beautiful, mystical beings who are waiting to enfold and embrace you on our Discord server. And also, once you subscribe, you'll have access to hours and hours and hours of extra DTFH content, including commercial-free episodes of this podcast. Again, that's patreon.com/DTFH. Okay, friends, without further ado, let's dive into this wonderful conversation with Raghu Marcus. He helps run the Love Serve Remember Foundation. It's Ram Dass's foundation. He has a wonderful podcast called Mind Rolling, which even before you listen to this, just press pause and subscribe. He interviews people who live in caves. Like, he has access to like people who probably can teleport. And you should listen to these wonderful conversations he has with them on Mind Rolling. Also, all the links you need to find Raghu-related content are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. And now welcome, Raghu Marcus.
Duncan Trussell. Hey everyone, we're back. Like we never left. Back with my departed soulmate who left me here in California, Duncan Trussell.
Hello everybody. Hi Raghu. Good to see you. Sorry
for same here, man.
Yeah. Well, everyone left everybody this year, didn't we? Like that's what I realized in LA was I'm not seeing anyone. Like everyone's zooming. What's the idea? Who cares where we could be? I could be on Mars. Wouldn't make much of a difference.
Yeah, right. That's true. Although hopefully we're heading in the right direction, but Pollyannish kind of maybe thinking, but
Aaron has given up in the sense of like she's noticing that I've been saying every few months, I think this is the end of it. And she's like, come on, Duncan. You just keep saying that. Eventually, you're going to be right.
Eventually, we will be right, all of us. But it won't be. There is no back to normal. So, because normal is gone. Right
well, that's now. To me, that you mentioned that yesterday on the phone. But that's a funny thing to even talk about is like that idea. The normal before the pandemic wasn't normal. You know what I mean? When was it normal? Like, at what point were things back to normal? You know, like, you go back. Some people say 2012. Actually, they were right. Because if you look at the world after 2012 and before 2012, two completely different worlds. Because prior to 2012, that's the internet is in more of an embryonic phase. You trace that back to pre-cell phone, you know, when answering machines were high-tech. When was it normal? All I'm saying is like, at what point was this normal? How do we go back to normal?
Yeah, that is absolutely 100% true. You know, but I'm thinking though is for everybody out there, Duncan now has two small children, and I've got a couple of other friends mutual to Duncan and I that are part of the community that have either are getting another one. Or already have a couple, and every time I was just with our friend John Faniff the other day. He's, you know, he's having a new baby coming along as well, and I said, I think I must have said something about there's no going back to the normal. What's the new normal? But really, it led me to start thinking about the way in which you guys particularly need to nurture these children in a way that they're going to have a planet that is livable. Let's start there. And they're the hope, right? You are raising the hope for humanity.
Wow.
Right?
That's cool.
Yeah.
Is a lot of pressure to put. You know what's so funny is I remember asking Ram Dass about some, you know, schmaltzy question about how do I be a dad? And his response was, my son. I said something about my son. He's like, first of all, remember, that's the role. Those are all roles. You know, son, role. Dad, role. He was so good at breaking it down. And so, and that little bit of magic that you just cast there in that spell, we've created a role, haven't we, for my son, which is savior of the known world. And also we've created a pretty intense role for me, which is to some kind of like, I've got to like tend to the Messiah over here. And you know what I mean? Like I've got to raise a Messiah now, Raghu. Yeah. I got
to
raise.
Well, no, two of them though. Now, you know, you keep just referring to one, but
yes.
There's two.
I know.
Two
you know boys. What? I'm sorry. Yes. Dune is still in, you know, the.
God.
Yes. Yeah, he's still beaming down, and it's beautiful. But both of them, you know, I think maybe part of part of the shift is figuring out ways to let our children be themselves outside of our expectation. It was hard enough. Fuck, my dad wanted me to play football. Now I'm going to want my kids to save the environment. You know what I mean? Like, gee, football I wasn't going to do. And certainly God knows, if you really do want your children to be this thing or that thing, don't act like it. You know what I mean? They'll both end up lumberjacks.
Yeah, no. Okay, what I'm talking about what I hear of spraying away the, what?
You know what's so funny about this spray that I just sprayed is, was in the bathroom of our old house, and you would spray it after you poop. And now every time I spray it, it just reminds me of poop, because the two have paired in my mind.
Yeah, right. That's great. No, what I'm talking about is what His Holiness has said repeatedly, the Dalai Lama, over the years, over many, many years, and that is humanity will be saved by our mothers.
Mm.
Okay? He said, I am, as you see me, I am as I am as a result of my mother's loving compassion. And the more that that can be expressed as we go forward, then that is what's going to be, he didn't say saving grace, but that is what is going to be the deepest affectation, on our on everything, the polarization, the planet, the discrepancy of rich and poor, all of it is by virtue of this development of compassion. So that's really what I'm talking about, and that is really what is happening in your little sphere and in the spheres of some of the other people that we're quite friendly with. So I think that, look at him. It's obvious, right? He is an obvious example of what got passed on to him by his mother, the compassionate loving kindness. So, I think that's what we're talking about. Well, more than trying to groom somebody to be the greatest environmentalist that ever lived. And no, it's just compassion, love, awareness.
I have been attempting to, I just go back to like Chogyam Trungpa talking about the best gift you can give your kids is to be fully in the moment with them.
Mm.
So when I'm with Forrest, I try to stay off the phone and I try to just be, and it doesn't work a lot of the time. You know, it's hard to be in the moment with a toddler, you know, because like you got to keep them from killing themselves or you're running in front of a car. But it's also not hard because they invite you into that realm, where the realm of novelty. Everything's new and it's beautiful. And from their perspective, the world is not fucked up. From their perspective, the world is perfect and wild and new. And it's some kind of elemental practice as much as I can of being in the moment. And then also of like, trying to practice something Trudy Goodman told me when I was telling her, Aaron and I had been fighting and feeling really guilty about that, fighting in front of him, which happens, and especially during the pandemic, but not trying to like make excuses for getting in fights in front of the kids, and Aaron and I discussed it. Should we hide fighting from him? Should we have our disagreements like when they've gone to bed? But what Trudy said was, it's not the fighting. They need to see you make up. It's learning that conflict happens. Sometimes arguments, sometimes, you know, uncomfortable, sometimes not good arguments happen. But if they can see that resolution happens, then they're going to learn it's not the end of the world to get into conflict with somebody. And it's just part of being alive and living with people. Because I think that's one of the things that some people had to deal with, the fact that their parents were miserable with each other, but were never fighting. They didn't know what was wrong or what was going on. That was being hidden. You know what I mean? Whereas like seeing conflict and then its hopeful resolution, I think that's something we can teach our kids. But, again, for me, as far as any of the utopian bullshit aside, It is one of the brilliant things Trungpa Rinpoche said that I also hold close to my heart is whatever your ism may be, you know, socialism, communism, whatever your particular utopian path forward to global harmony, if you really want to impact the planet, then find a way to be harmonious in your own house. And that, to me, was a summation of it all. The E equals MC squared of what I think a lot of the environmentalists who are rightfully upset and rightfully freaking out are looking for, which is it's not enough to ask for the collective to do something. We need a pragmatic methodology that on the subjective level, the individual can utilize in the moment and day to day, which is, okay, you fucked up. You got in a fight. You got something, you and your wife or your brother and your sister or whatever, having disagreements. Okay, that's the world. That's the world. You're just experiencing the world because that's what's happening on the macro. Okay, well, that's great because that means you're like a little beaker. You're all the troubles of the world in this tiny little pixel. Now, what can you do to harmonize this? And you know, not to keep, I'm going to stop this right now, but what I've noticed is it seems to be that trying to be right just doesn't seem to be a very good strategy when it comes to finding harmony. I know, and that's
righteousness is the last thing that goes. I mean, one of the last things that goes.
My dear darlings, we live in the age of Kali Yuga, the age of disintegration and entropy, which means everything is getting way more uncomfortable than it was when our parents were sleeping soundly in their non-pandemic world of comfort and safety. We don't have that anymore. But one thing I can always count on for comfort is my purple pillow. That's because purple is comfort reinvented. Only purple has the grid, a stretchy gel material that's amazingly supportive for your back and legs while cushioning your shoulders, neck, and hips. I don't know how it does it. It's just fantastic. Of course, I only have a purple pillow. I don't have a purple mattress. I wish I did. The pillow, though, is a go-to clutcher. I hug it. I sleep on it. It's fantastic. And that's because of how it's designed. The grid doesn't trap air. Air actually circulates and flows through it, so you'll never overheat. The grid bounces back as you move and shift, unlike memory foam, which remembers everything. That's why memory foam has craters and divots and is inevitably bitter. This purple pillow I have, friends, it truly is like something out of the Starship Enterprise. I know you've got mattress fatigue. You've heard everyone yapping, especially about pillow technologies. And I know you probably have a type of classical conditioning from other unsavory fascist pillow vendors out there. But I'm telling you, this pillow is amazing. I really love it. You should try it. You can try your purple mattress risk-free right now with free shipping and returns. Financing is available too. Purple really is comfort for an uncomfortable world. Right now, you'll get 10% off any order of $200 or more. Go to purple.com/Duncan10 and use promo code Duncan10. That's purple.com/Duncan10, promo code Duncan10 for 10% off any order of $200 or more. purple.com/Duncan10, promo code Duncan10. Terms apply. Thank you, Purple.
I think I told you when we chatted the other day that I had done a podcast with the people who are deeply involved with environmental activism. And, they have a thing called Full Ecology. It's worth listening to, actually. But their thing was, and this goes along with everything in terms of the tradition that we come out of through Ram Dass's lens, you've got to work inside yourself, to think that you can add anything to any issue. And they went on about this because, and it really made sense about the way in which we are dealing with ourselves and the way in which we are relating with ourselves has so much to do with how we relate to the most simple of things, like what's going on in our very, very closed environment, and how are we just looking at everything that we do from moment to moment. The way we might ignore something, we ignore that inside ourselves. We are ignoring and not paying attention, and then we're ignoring and not paying attention outside ourselves.
Yes.
It's such a, I loved it because it really was so holistic, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is I think, and again, I have had some environmentalists on my podcast who are legitimately terrified. And so, I understand, you know, like people who work at NASA and understand how, you know, the structure of carbon and like the tragedy of that shape in relation to the planet and the, like, you know, the kind of fear you can only get from like deeply looking into a thing, and also the passion behind trying to get people to change. You know, in the real legitimate anger and frustration when you realize like nobody's changing. Like I'm telling them exactly what is like the culmination of not just my own lifetime of research, but the culmination of like the lifetimes of so many different scientists. And this is, wasn't this why we wanted science? Isn't this why we wanted science so we can say, look, we have to change. And if we don't, you don't understand, you know, but no, nobody's changing. And so why, what's the problem here? And I think that one of the problems is that in the messaging of, oh yeah, you don't even understand. Like right now, if we just stopped, every single one of us stopped emitting carbon, we're still fucked. See, that's part of the message. It's like, oh, no, you don't understand. Like, we're fucked. Like, it's we're fucked. And then, so in that messaging, you're suddenly, you feel completely disempowered. And humans are all about power. There's no point. So then at that point, we sink into nihilism or denial. And then, so nothing happens. So the idea is we've got to find a way on the subjective level for people to feel that their positive participation in the world is more than just pissing into the ocean. And otherwise, forget it. There's nothing's going to happen, you know? And so I think that a lot of people are working on those fronts in a lot of different ways, which is we need to get people to actually really understand how powerful they are as an individual. And not in some bullshit way, but you just don't know. The problem is you really can't understand how deeply you're impacting things around you, which is something I've been very interested in lately, you know, studying quantum physics and the craziness that's happening on the quantum level of the universe, but from a perspective, an ecological perspective, it's a really interesting thing, you know? Anyway, the point is, I think what Ram Dass was so good at is sorry for this tangent, but we are the quantum level of society. You know, you're a quark. I'm an electron. You know, Aaron's a neutrino or whatever. But the point is, we're all part of this beautiful supersymmetry called society. And we're witnessing the symmetry in the things that appear on the world stage. The calving of the ice sheets, the wars, the appearance of demagogues or tyrants. That's the supersymmetry, the manifestation of the collective in the negative. But the implication of that is that the opposite is also possible. And that's where you get a Ram Dass. That's where you get a Dalai Lama. That's where you get a Neem Karoli Baba, which is that if there's these tyrant possibilities and war possibilities, then the opposite must also be true. That's part of the symmetry. And if it's not true, then we're doomed anyway. But, you know, we're doomed because it's endless war forever until the environment collapses. collapses. But I just, where there's a thing, its opposite must exist.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
My point is, we have to find a way to engage people in an optimistic worldview that isn't delusional.
Mm-hmm. And I think that what you and I have been discussing over now, it's going on to a couple, 3 years, this whole thing about the complete grasping and belief in the me that we live with on a day-to-day basis. I do think it's a really great way to start a conversation along the lines of what you have just mentioned. How do we create, help to create a space of optimism, subjective optimism, where we believe that there is a way to positively affect all of these different very difficult situations, from the environment to the racial injustice to the inequities, economic inequities, and all of it. And I came across, I think I told you this the other day, excuse me, I came across a talk by Krishnamurti, who happens to live around the corner from me right now. I mean, his vibration, it's Krishnamurti Center here in Ojai. And this talk was with I don't know what denomination he was. He was a priest. They never said, there was nothing on the YouTube thing that suggested who he is or who he was, whatever. And we'll put up a link, though, with it in the show notes here so people can watch it themselves. But I did, there were some fabulous things. Basically, the whole thing started out with, is it possible to completely empty the mind of the me? That was the premise, right? Is it possible? So we can sort of pick this apart a little bit and add our own thing to it. Is there a process to rid the quote-unquote me? And you know him. I mean, if you have not ever heard Krishnamurti or read any of his things, he was really a spiritual maverick in a way. He put down all of it. And there's a, oh, God, I guess I got to tell this story. Krishnamurti used to travel in the foothills of the Himalayas where Neem Karoli Baba was.
Yeah.
And where we spend a lot of time with him in a place called Kenchi. And so they knew each other. And one day he came to the ashram and our mentor, K.C. Tiwari, who we're just finishing a wonderful documentary film on called Brilliant Disguise, because he was really a powerful yogi dressed as a school teacher, a headmaster of a school. So he happened to be there this one day that Krishnamurti came. And Maharaji said to Tiwari, okay, I'm going to take him over to the river. You get, you know, just get a little bit away, you know, but you'll be there. So he sat on a rock and Krishnamurti and Maharaji sat down. Krishnamurti started regaling Neem Karoli Baba, Maharaji, saying, "What, you're like a wandering mendicant, sadhu. What are you doing with all these ashrams? Look at all this attachment that you've created."
Yeah.
Like that. Not exactly those words, but pretty much. And you know, Maharaji said, "You're right. You're absolutely right. But it's the way I get my grub. That's how I get my grub,"
he said. Cool.
And then he looked at Krishnamurti and he said, "Gee, don't you go around the world giving talks and lectures?
Yeah.
Isn't that's the way you get your grub, right?
Yeah.
So they had this phenomenal conversation, right? So Krishnamurti, who did not believe in gurus or anything like that, this was, you know, he was the bottom line. He made Zen seem like a wild bhakti fest, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
So what he said here is that there is no process to eliminate the me, right? Everybody, and then he started to describe the me is everything that is going through that brain is the me. Mm. And he said, so he gets into it a little bit further and he says, if I say by me, and I'm going to throw that me out, it's still that me throwing the me out. So this is where he goes, you know, with, can the conscious mind examine the unconscious me and expose it? Mm. I pose that to you. Can the conscious mind examine the unconscious? So awareness, you know, brings in the whole of the Buddhist concepts of mindfulness and awareness. Can it, you know, expose that? Hmm. You know, can it? And all right, you get a first crack at it.
Well, the discussion of me is really interesting, and it has popped up with some friends also as we're talking about the whole me thing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because. Well, I was having a conversation with one of my friends. They were asking something along the lines of, I feel like I'm too afraid to jump into the abyss. And it reminded me of a question I asked Ram Dass at one of the retreats. I just put it in a different way, which is like, you seem like someone who jumped off the diving board, and I feel like I've camped out on the edge. And he got this big smile, and he said, there's no diving board. Remember that? There's no jumping. No. It's all a, you know, you're creating the structure. You're creating that in your head. And the abyss one, we were laughing about it because I was, you know, that saying like, when you look at the abyss stares back. And I was thinking probably the abyss is looking at you thinking, fuck, look at that scary abyss. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
That's a terrifying abyss. And it, like, so in the conversation of me, really, it's a kind of like sweet thing in the sense that you're excited to imagine that you're encumbered by this thing. You know, it's because if you are encumbered by the thing, well, it must be real, right? And then if it's real, then I must have some solidity. And then if I have some solidity, I've got a me. You know, that's the whole
thing. Separate me.
Right. Yep. So no matter which way you go at it, which is the, I've got to get rid of my me. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to be me. You know, both of these things, if the central premise is, well, what the fuck is the me?
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to give you his definition of the me. Okay, the me is the entire conceptual ideation of oneself. Mm. It's the content of the entire content of my consciousness, thinking, mind, emotions, feelings, all of it, all the senses. It's the entire content. And as long as the content of my consciousness remains, there will be separation between you and me. And that is the key. I mean, when I heard this, I was like, okay, that's the key of what you and I have been talking about in terms of what there's nothing that can happen in any way. And I mean just simple things like being happy, being able to be in a relationship, not just with a wife or husband, but in relationship to people. Nothing can happen until this is transformed. And now it just, you know, and it doesn't happen. And I like what he said, that the idea that there's a process. Like, that's how we've been talking, you know, when we've been putting together the ideas for the from the movie of me to the movie of us. We've been talking as if there's a starting process and an ending, you know, there's an end. There's a beginning and an end. And what he's saying, which is really fascinating, it is not about process at all.
Yeah.
It is about perspective. That's how he ends up with this thing.
Yeah. This episode is sponsored by Blue Chew. Say it with us, Blue Chew! Blue Chew is making waves and bringing more confidence to the bedroom by offering chewable tablets that can help men get stronger and longer lasting erections. Thank you, God. Blue Chew is a unique online service that delivers the same active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, but in chewable form and at a fraction of the cost. Thank you, God. Blue Chew's tablets help men achieve harder, stronger erections to combat all forms of erectile dysfunction. Blue Chew, it's an online prescription service, so no visits to the doctor's office, no awkward conversations, no waiting in line at the pharmacy, and it ships right to your door in a discreet package. The process is simple. You sign up at BlueChew.com, consult with one of their licensed medical providers, and once you're approved, you'll receive your prescription within days. The best part? It's all done online. Blue Chew's licensed medical providers work with you to find the right ingredient and strength for your prescription. Don't like swallowing pills? No problems here. Blue Chew's Sildenafil and Tadalafil tablets are chewable. Blue Chew's tablets are made in the USA and they prepare and ship direct, so it's cheaper than a pharmacy. So if you could benefit from extra confidence when it's time to perform, and by perform we mean hump, visit BlueChew.com for more details and important safety information. Again, friends, I only advertise things that I actively use, and I use Blue Chew. We've got a special deal for our listeners. Try Blue Chew free when you use our promo code Duncan at checkout. Just pay $5 shipping. That's BlueChew.com, promo code Duncan, to receive your first month free. That's free erections on the DTFH. And we thank Blue Chew for sponsoring the podcast. But I mean, I do think it's fun. Like, I think that's kind of one of the cool and infuriating things about Krishnamurti is, like, you know, he really does make himself out to be some kind of authority, and he seems so charismatic. But it's like, okay, well, that's just because you said that's what the meat was. Like,
well, wait, no. I mean, we have our own experience. Is not your experience that the content, the story you tell yourself is content. The way in which you look at other people and project them to be one thing or another based on memories or whatever.
Yeah.
That's all true.
But it's kind of like Krishnamurti drawing a circle like in the sky. I mean, that's the sky. It's like, you know what I mean? I do feel like it's a funny, you know, this is from my own exploration of the me stuff. Playing around with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, there's another like wonderful encounter between Krishnamurti and Trungpa Rinpoche where Krishnamurti's doing his like thing. And, you know, again, I'm not trying to take sides in something because both of these are like, when I'm looking at it, I'm like, so what is this where spirituality was in those days? Was this what it was like? Cage matches between spiritual superstars confronting each other over like this stuff? Even with like young Ram Dass and Trungpa Rinpoche, these two young spiritual stars. And it's like, what's going on here? Like these confrontations between, you know, I'm going to go to Neem Karoli Baba and say, you shouldn't be doing this thing. It's like, because of so many stories of this with Krishnamurti, though I do have a lot of respect for him, his intelligence, his intellect. I always get an empty feeling from him, not in a good way.
Absolutely.
Like, what are you like, some kind of spiritual arm wrestler going around from ashram to ashram trying to get like in some embarrassing ego competition with spiritual teachers? It's an embarrassment. And because of that, for someone who is so wrapped up in challenging me's with his me, it's hard for me to take anything he says.
Okay, you
got to
get But now that's exactly what this is about: content of consciousness. Who cares where he's coming from? He, in my little belief system of advanced beings, etc., etc., there's not at the level of one like a Neem Karoli Baba that was no longer living in subjective anything. I mean, because you can even see in this talk where the priest says, kind of catches him, okay, so you're saying you should be doing this, you know, oh no, there's no doing anything, you know, he backs off and all of that. But you know,
you
got to
watch
Duncan,
the Trumpa Rinpoche one, because Chogyam Trumpa just sits there and like it's very quiet and just lets Krishnamurti be Krishnamurti, and like it really seems to start rattling him. Because he's like,
I don't know
his
that.
Question to Trumpa Rinpoche was something about why I add meditation to people's problems. What's this meditation thing? And so he's like, is just being very quiet and he's sitting there. He's not really answering the question, but he's in the moment with him. And then it just rattles Krishnamurti because there's nothing to, he's looking for a fight.
Yeah, nothing to grab onto.
Yeah. But regardless, I'm creating a fake Krishnamurti and now I'm fighting with him. So I'm doing the same
damn
thing. Yeah,
right. You're right in there.
It's like part of it. But sure. One of the things Trumpa Rinpoche said that I love is confusion is on the continuum of enlightenment. And so, or a condition of enlightenment. So in other words, the problem with the me circumference, however you want to draw it, is that what is the me happening inside of? And so, you know, this is where I think the me starts running into some real trouble, in the sense that the regardless of whether your me is your Twitter bio or, you know, your recollection of how your memories or how you tend to act in any given moment, you're always thwarted by the sort of non-continuity of the damn thing. It's always changing. You're kind of making it up in the moment. That's the problem. You're making it up. You're having to you're adhering to some meanest thing. You know what I mean? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like,
yeah, no, absolutely. But at the same, he calls the me is the mischief of the world, because it's in living in separation. It's in fear of losing stuff. It's in hope of gaining. It's preferences. It's choices. It's looking at people by virtue of how is that going to help me or not help me. It's,
yeah,
at the most subtle levels, you know. So it is mischief. And
what does he think? Like it's a mistake?
No, but we're going to get there.
Okay.
But I just wanted to kind of parse this a little bit. But just to say about Krishnamurti, yes, he's a real brain. He's, you know, and he brings up stuff that's good to pull apart.
He challenges everything. It's cool.
Yeah. But, you know, and the rest of it, who cares? You know, his thing about, you don't need to do practice, meditate, you know, coming on to Trumpa Rinpoche about meditation. I mean, Trumpa Rinpoche, is a highly, highly advanced being, whatever. And I would be taking that kind of advice in terms of the ways in which he discussed, what meditation really is moving into the gap, for instance, between thoughts. And that is the way in which one can transform this deep grasping onto the story we tell ourselves, the me. But one of the things, advice is probably not the right word for him, because there's no advice, there's nothing. But being honest, otherwise one tends to deceive oneself. Mm. So we did this whole thing with Ram Dass, my friend David Silver and I, who had started the Mind Rolling podcast with.
Yes.
And because I always felt like one of the biggest things I got from Ram Dass when I first met him, and then all the way through the years, was his ability for self-honesty.
Yes.
Not to bullshit himself.
Yeah.
And that was like, I got to say, that's right at the top few, if I'm to say what I got from Ram Dass over all those years.
that was right at the very top few.
Yeah.
The ability to do that, because there's so much fear around being on, which is why I wanted to do this whole journey with you around the movie of me to the movie of us. And I've said this more than once to you. I was getting so sick of, you know, I had enough honesty, I thought, to see the sickness. The sickness meaning the mischief that, and I like that word mischief better than sickness, in terms of the transparency of the motivations, which are so self-interested, self-cherishing, and all of those great Buddhist terms. It just got to the point where got to do something. And in the doing of it, between you and I over these last couple of years, probably more, in the doing of it, we have come to be able to maybe offer something that allows us to be clear about how the effect of living in this kind of separate reality and how it's affecting us so deeply, and it's affecting everything around us. And so, self-honesty is a primary way in which we can really look at ourselves and not run away.
Well, yeah, I think that looking at yourself, self-knowing, that's the start of it. I mean, again, like, not to keep beating up on Krishnamurti, but come on.
Yeah.
He's like the grumpiest.
He can take it.
He's a grump.
I'll run over to his center and after this.
He just seemed every single thing. I'm sorry, all the Krishnamurti fans out there. It's just like, I got to go with my instincts here. And I think the reason whenever I like leave some encounter with Krishnamurti, just thinking like, ugh, no thanks, is versus Ram Dass, is because Krishnamurti is, of course he's going to use the word mischief. He's like a get out of my yard kid person. You know what I mean? Mischief. Whereas Ram Dass, he invites you to look at yourself like it's a flower. Look at all that karma. Look at that. And love it. It's not looking at yourself like, oh, this mischief here. Oh, this mistake of the universe. Oh, this aberration in the great cosmic everythingness that I am. Whereas Krishnamurti is like, ah, oh, the mischief of the world. Get out of town, Krishnamurti. No thanks. I like the... Because let's talk about that moment when you've lost control and you've become your worst you. Maybe it's in the moment. Maybe it's the repercussion afterwards when you find yourself sitting by yourself, feeling all of it. And I'm not saying the guilt or the shame, but also the righteousness and the power and all of it mixing together.
Everything.
And the mournfulness and the sadness. But in that moment where you weren't Ram Dass or Krishnamurti or whoever you imagine you might be in some incarnation, but were actually you encounter truth. And when you're looking at it afterwards, you're not seeing it like, oh, that's who I want to be. But if you for a second don't judge it, and you're like, this is my karma. This is who I am right now for real. And it isn't right. It's not good, or it doesn't. It is mischievous, or it doesn't fit into the idea of a harmonious world. But it's real, and that's where I'm at. Here, not whatever the fuck I thought I was, but no, this is you, this is me for real. This density, the anger, the potential to cause untold pain to those around me, the potential to lose everything and all of it. Those moments, I think it's worth noting that thing is very, very powerful. And that thing is very, is not all bad. In fact, I don't know if it's bad at all. It just is. It just is.
There's no bad or good. It just is.
That's it. So when Krishnamurti is applying mischief or terms like that to the damn thing, I think that it represents more of a bad mood than some like assessment of the thing. And I don't think it's going to help anything.
Yeah, but I think to me, it's just tone. I mean, you who've been doing podcasts forever and me when I I learned this when I was doing radio way back in the day. It's all about tone. And, you know, I can say, for instance, you know, when something goes awry and I see it, and I can say, gee, there's mischievous me happening again. I can say it in a way that it is guilt, shame, judgmental, and so on. Or I can say it in a way, and this is how the difference between Krishnamurti, probably what you're trying to say, and Ram Dass is, have a sense of humor about it. Yeah. Oh, there's that mischievous little guy again. He's just trying to hold on, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So I really think it's in the tone. Now, where this comes round to is interesting, because where he came around to it in this dialogue that he had with this priest was around perspective. That was the entire game changer. And it made me think, okay, so what are we talking about? We're talking about, you know, we've been using Ram Dass as our centerpiece here, of somebody who was very much human and very much able to let go of the me in the moment. And you, when I first brought you to Ram Dass's house, I mean, you just were swimming in that, where there was no necessity to be or not be anything, and there was no judgment, there was nothing but just a spacious quality of a total acceptance.
Yes.
And he was able to do that. But the perspective, so like I just mentioned this tonal thing around the word mischief. Tonally, it can be just a completely bullshit, judgmental asshole thing. Or tonally, it can be a humorous, spacious thing.
Yeah.
So what's the perspective? So the perspective, and Ram Dass brought this out the last maybe 10 years he was in Maui, right? I think you were there for most of the last 10 years. And loving awareness.
Yeah.
That was the perspective. He was saying, you easily can take a few breaths into the center of your being, into the center of your chest, and move that consciousness out of the me story into the unity story.
Yeah.
And from there, you can laugh about all of it and not take yourself so seriously, self-serious.
Yeah.
And you aren't judging yourself or anybody else. You're not moving towards the preference to be comfy or pushing away the tough stuff in life. Your perspective is the key. And this is what, you know, he ended up saying this as well, Krishnamurti. I'm defending Krishnamurti now against you because you have defiled this extraordinary philosophical saint.
Hey, that's what he did to everybody else. You're allowed. He gave us all permission to do that. To me, the idea of unconditional positive regard, Carl Rogers, Rogerian therapy, it's because he couldn't, I think when Carl Rogers came up with the term unconditional positive regard, he knew he couldn't say love and be respected by academics, so he had to come up with another word.
I don't know him.
Carl Rogers, I'm okay, you're okay. Rogerian, well, so...
Oh, yeah, I've heard that, but I don't know the name.
One of the great stories that they told about Carl Rogers when I was in school was that it stuck with me, and it's what Ram Dass that spaciousness that you're talking about, and it's what apparently Neem Karoli Baba did, and I guess you could say Ram Dass is a reflection of that spaciousness, but... Some kid was about to get basically put into like a juvenile detention facility because he was misbehaving so much, you know, but I think it was a very young kid. So it didn't make, you know, it's like too young to be this like out of control, and everyone had tried everything. And so Carl Rogers had them bring the kid to him, and this kid walks into his office And the way Rogers describes this kid looking at him is like, this is a kid who's been to God knows how many therapists, already pissed off that he's got to go to another one, doesn't give a shit about any of this. And sitting on Carl Rogers' desk is like crayons and paper. And the kid says to him, I'm not, something along the lines of, I'm not going to fucking talk. And Carl Rogers said, oh, you don't have to talk. And the kid just starts drawing. For the whole hour, Carl Rogers just sits there trying to hold a space of unconditional positive regard for this poor kid who everybody was trying to change. Everybody was saying, mischief, mischief, mischief. You better be better. You better be this or that. And suddenly he's in the presence of someone who's like, just do your thing as you are right now. The kid comes back, same thing. Comes back, starts talking a little bit. And then as the story goes, the kid, all the teachers are like, what have you been doing? What? He's a completely different person. And all that had happened was this genius was letting a child be themselves with nothing. And it reminds me of the story Ram Dass tells about Neem Karoli Baba, where he, maybe it's transmitted in a look or something, but within the look is, when do you want to do this? You want to keep reincarnating forever? That's okay. You can play the game for as long as you want, or you don't have to play it anymore if you don't want to. I'm the thing that I'm the non-playing of the game, but however you want to do it. And within that spaciousness, that seems to be where the transformation happens. And from the quantum perspective, not to try to put it into some pop science bullshit, it's really interesting the way at the quantum level, photons act as a particle and a wave simultaneously. But if you observe it, it pops into one or the other. But somehow the effect of observation forces it into either showing up as a particle, showing up as a wave. My physicist friends out there, I'm sorry if I fucked it up. But I spent some time watching various versions of this thing, which I believe is called the double slit experiment, where you shoot light through and there's a way to show it as a wave or a particle. But a superposition is the name for when something is these two seemingly completely different things simultaneously. And so in thinking about meditation, non-judgmental awareness, unconditional positive regard, I feel like it's that moment of allowing yourself to simultaneously be a me, the particle of identity, and the great ocean of everythingness. These two things somehow existing simultaneously, meaning that we're not in the act of some demo crew trying to knock a building down anymore. It's just part of what we are. It's the particle. It's not mischievous. Yeah. Is a particle of light mischievous? No. But it's not everything we are. We're also...
No, wait. No, come on. It's the mischievous part is, I mean, not to harp on this, but the mischievous part is just the self-interested part, okay? It's the part of us that wants to protect our territory, wants to take advantage in every way so that we can advance ourselves in whatever way that makes us feel more comfy, more powerful, all of that. So that's just that part. But you're absolutely right. This isn't about we don't have that old me anymore. We're going to live in the undivided now, and where we recognize where, you know, the particles and the waves are one, and we're not seeing them separate.
Right.
That's not a reality. We are human.
Yeah.
We have got to operate. It's part of our humanness on a day-to-day basis. There's a great story. I don't know if I can tell this though, and it fits. But basically, it's the idea of, you are a me. You've got the me.
Yes.
You became the separate me when you were given a name, and then move forward, and you've got all of the grasping, all of the terror of the causes and conditions that have made you whatever that me is. And then you start to wake up, and you start to think, okay, wait, there is another
possibility. You do that through psychedelics. You do it through hearing a talk of Ram Dass or anybody, or Alan Watts. You do it through meeting somebody. You do it just you and I, what we've been doing, the way in which we're sharing this creates the possibility and the new perspective. And once you have that, all that happens in my mind is there's a lessening of that grasping.
Yeah.
That makes you so, the feeling of separation is so powerful by this grasping that you have no way of having a harmonious interaction with the environment, with the people that you're in relation to, with your work, yeah. with any of it. And I think that that's what really needs to be understood. I'm Krishnamurti. Look, needs to be understood. He wouldn't like that. That's what comes about once we step onto a path of knowing that there is something beyond this me land.
Yes, and like there's a so many different methods related around sort of loosening the grasping, yeah. or loosening the. It's really more like a. I think grasping is a. It's more like a muscle spasm. It's like when you have a really bad leg cramp, except you're the universe having the leg cramp. And it's a little, it's painful. But for me, the...
it is painful. You got, that's an important
cramping
thing.
Is painful. I mean, yeah. Suffering...
And it gets to the point where you can't stand it.
Well,
you know?
But then also, this is... This is where we get into the really interesting addictive quality of it, like, or the subtle nuances of the thing, which is, again, like, suddenly your relationship. So at first, your relationship with yourself is naturally undifferentiated in the sense that you just think you're your mom, you're part of the ocean of isness. And then you begin to differentiate from your parents, and suddenly you're a you, and now you're going to, you want things your way. This is the toddler situation. And then this continues to like crystallize until you become an adult, which is just like a sort of neurological thumbprint of various habituations that you've assembled as a whatever you think you are. But what's been quite useful to me has not, well, first of all, what hasn't worked for me is the destructive approach, which a lot of people are into these days. God knows you get the emails. I do too, where people are like, I obliterated my ego on 3,000 micrograms of LSD. And the language is always war language. Obliterated, smashed, demolished. Yeah. And you know, and so the language itself demonstrates, number one, the recognition of, oh God, this thing called my me is causing so much pain that I want to go to fucking war with it. But then also, it seems to be a little bit of ignorance in the sense like, wait, so you're going to try to relieve yourself of the pain of the me by blowing it up, by exploding it, by, dropping bombs on it? How's that going to work?
By the way, Ram Dass, he used to say, like he'd advise people, if you have dark thoughts... He first started out going, love them to death.
Yeah.
And then a couple of years later, it's too violent. That kind of, that leads you into something that is even further polarizing.
Yeah. Well, again, we're a war culture. We've been, 93% of American history, we've been at war. So we're like Klingons, essentially, in Star Trek. Like the way we understand the world is war and conquering and colonization. And so we take that approach against ourselves when we start having some recognition of our suffering. Anyway, the point is like that idea of confusion being a condition of enlightenment, I've always loved it. And I didn't understand it at first. I think I understand it a little more now, but I guess the way to, David Nickturn told me this funny joke. A funny spiritual joke, and there's a lot of shitty spiritual jokes. I'll probably butcher it, but basically, I think a student is on one side of a river. his teacher's on the other side of the river, and he yells to his teacher, "I want to get to the other shore." And his teacher yells back, "You are on the other shore." And it's, do you know what I mean? So it's like where it gets addictive, for the addiction to really work, or the spiritual high thing to work, you have to create another shore. And now you've got the spiritual path. And now you're on a journey from the profane to the sacred. And within that journey, there's all these chances to get completely blasted, you know, because, oh my God, now you're having this cherished moment, because truly you're melting like a sugar cube into the ocean. But then all of a sudden you're not anymore, and you're back down to your shitty self again. Ah, and then you're melting again and back. And now all you're doing is getting high. That's all you're doing, is doing this weird form of spiritual
bypass, it's called.
I don't know if it's
it's bypass in that it's just feeding the same ego that was being fed before there was a spiritual path in one's life.
I'm referring to this thing that was discussed in this book, which I'll tell you right now.
Yeah.
It's called, let me open my Audible here. Wonderful, wonderful Buddhist scripture called, let me find it. It's one of the key Buddhist, it's about bodhicitta aspiration. Oh yeah, it's called Way of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva. Very wonderful.
Oh, I mean, that's incredible.
Wonderful. And he's talking about this bodhicitta idea. And, but he's mentioning all these different things you can do as someone who's waking up, or however you want to put it, or cultivating bodhicitta, moving through the realms. And one of the things you can do is actually cultivate this compassion, loving awareness, mindfulness to a certain degree, where you begin to experience all the awesome things that go along with it, which I think are, could best be described as little miracles all the time, or little synchronicities, or the relief that comes from, you know, recognizing you're just in a bad dream and you're probably going to wake up soon. It's really quite nice. But there's a possibility here within even that of intentionally going back to sleep, putting yourself back to sleep because of the thrilling exhilaration of waking back up. You essentially turn yourself into this fucking yo-yo. It's true. I'm telling you, people do it all the time. And I think part of the problem, so to speak, is that it might just be that this way that things are, all of the you-ness and all the me-ness and all the confusion is just the way things are. Doesn't get better. Doesn't get worse. This is it. And people, that's intolerable. It's intolerable. Because the great dream is there's this thing around the corner that once I do the chakra exercises and the purifications and the mantras and the thing and get the initiation and then get the thing and then get all that, and then somewhere around the corner is great hope. But what if it is hopeless in the sense, no, you're there. Deal with that. Holy fuck, it can't be. You mean just this? No, then I've just got to be me. Then I can't exert aggression against myself. So now what am I going to do?
Wait, let's. I like to think of this in practical terms, as to that once the shift starts to happen, I've had a shift over many decades that I can, and I have noticed, and that is really what I, only thing I am concerned about for myself and you and others that are around me is moving in the perspective shifts without, I don't even know why. Yes, I do practices. Yes, I've been with incredible beings. Yes, starting with Neem Karoli Baba and ending there, really, and hanging out with Ram Dass as much as I did. But something happens, and it's due to something that I was going to tell this story a little earlier. It's called grace.
Yeah.
And something happens. So, but the practical application of it is certainly I am not reactive the way that I was earlier in my life.
Right.
Period. I am not.
And it has helped me with the anger issues that I've carried in this life. It has helped me with just being more open. And I talk about that openness, that spaciousness, that self-honesty, the way in which Ram Dass talks about loving that quote-unquote Krishnamurti mischief.
Mischief man.
It's just a happening.
Yeah.
It is inevitable. It's an inevitable happening.
Yeah.
It is our human, the human reality is certainly this ego, me, me thing. And getting entrapped. And you're saying, well, people fall asleep so they can wake up again because it's so much fun.
They do.
You know, and maybe that's, you know, I would say that people do a lot of psychedelics just for the experience. That may be true.
And very retreats. True in that.
Yeah. And retreats and whatever, meditation course. But again, it's all in, I say it's tone when we talk about a word like mischief that we've been talking about. It's all in, it's an honest intention.
Yes.
Allows for transformation.
That I love. That I love. The honest intention. That I love. And that took me a long time to get to that one. And I love it. And I think that that's, if you are trying to find, and I'm saying hold on to something, but to me it seems more like a mnemonic device than anything, which is, you know, in all the, like, you were describing, you were reading some beautiful Buddhist description of death as being like being in a blizzard. And or like the like so dizzying and so lost, so you know I do like having a little an intention like that that I can refer to when I've lost all reason or all like wait what was I even doing any of this for, what was I doing this for, I don't even know what any of this shit is, just that little intention of like okay, I'm gonna try to be a little kinder today. Or it's like in Annie Lamott's new book, I believe she put, just trying to be a little, God, I think their prayer was, God, let me be a little less of an asshole today.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But just some simple thing like that. So,
totally.
So that I have a thing. But then part of, to me, part of being less of an asshole, having really become adept in earlier years at beating myself up and hating myself and all the various methods I used to sort of hurt myself, it didn't achieve the goal of some kind of stable happiness. So, and if it did, I think we'd be living in a paradise world. In other words, like if we're going to go back to like, we need some subjective methodology for improving our internal ecosystem, which maybe then will reflect into the world. I think the first step has got to be peace. We're like, in other words, we're calling an end to this war against the mischief person. Mm. The mischief man and I, maybe we're not going to get along for a while. And maybe the things the mischief man wants to do, like snort ketamine for the next 50 years straight, and what I need to do is a
good idea.
What I need to do as a father and a husband and a provider, don't mix. And I'm going to be the one calling the shots in that regard, the father part, not the mischief man. Also, I understand why. And I know why that he wants to do that. I know why he likes it. And I understand why the addiction is there. And I get it. But all I'm saying is the war mentality, even using the language of war to refer to ourselves, is not useful. So to me, there's a big relief in what you're saying. The relief being, this is a process. Like, you're not really quite in as, you might not be in control at all. But, and that scares the shit out of the mischief man, because the mischief man wants to be in complete control of everything. But when you start recognizing, oh, wonderful. Like, when I look back and think, wait, how did I even meet Raghu? Well, how did I get to end up at Ram Dass's house? Or why do I get to have pictures of Neem Karoli Baba all over my house now? Why do I get to have that? Or why did my child in the womb get to be in the presence of Ram Dass or any of these things? Like, when I look back and think, what was the right thing I did? Like, what was the thing to deserve that? And when you know what I mean? And then when you realize, oh, I don't know that there was or if there was, there wasn't.
Here, this brings up the story that that's my third time saying, gee, I don't know if I should tell this story. Well, it's not.
I love your stories.
No, you don't. You hate all those miracle stories.
That was earlier. That was earlier. Right.
Now you love them. Okay, I'll give you a whole
bunch. I don't love them, but I like that.
This isn't about that. This is a story that's been told many times, but it's so apropos to what you just said, what we've been talking about, because everything we're talking about is in duality, right? Trying to fix. No, don't fix. Krishnamurti said, there's no fixing. There's no process. There's no nothing. Yeah. There's just perspective that takes place. This is a conversation that Ram Dass had with Neem Karoli Baba in Allahabad one day many years ago, where Ram Dass said, Maharaji, is it not true that karma and grace are the same? Hmm. How could they be different? Action and grace.
That's intense.
And you know the story. No. But Maharaji's. No?
I don't remember it. Sorry to cut you off.
Well, it's good. I love people who have no memories anymore. I can tell the story and they act like they never heard it before. It's like so refreshing. Anyhow, he said, Ram Dass, I am not talking. This is not something I can talk about. He didn't say it exactly like, this is not something that I'm going to talk about in public.
Yes.
And there wasn't anybody there except us, you know. So later in the day, in that day, Dada Mukherjee, the great, by his grace, get that book. You want to know anything about Neem Karoli Baba, that's the book.
It is good.
I just threw that in there because it's true. He came to Ram Dass and said, Ram Dass, Maharaji said to tell you that Ram Dass and I understand each other quite well.
Wow.
So Ram Dass thought, okay, must be that they are, and he couldn't talk about it, and so on and so forth. Fast forward to not that long ago, maybe about 8 years ago, I was in India with Siddhi Ma, who was with Maharaji forever and is a saint in her own right. It was our Indian mother, and just an extraordinary being. I asked her. I told her that whole story, and I said, what's the truth, Ma? And she said, it is true that they are one, but no, human minds cannot fathom that. Mm. You need to act as if they are not one.
Right.
Until the other thing happens, which is ineffable and we can't talk about, we have no idea about, where you lose complete subject-object and you are now just part of the universal divine presence, whatever the hell we want to call it. So in your case, in my case, how the hell did I end up in India? I'm saying the same thing as you. You know, how did I end up in the pool with Ram Dass? You know, I was in terrible shape. I say the same. I was in terrible shape. How the hell did I end up in looking in Ram Dass's eyes and going, wow, I trust this guy.
Yeah.
Period. And that pushed me to India. I had to meet whoever the hell it was that he trusted. I had to meet. And I went and did that.
Yeah.
How did that all happen? There is something going on that is not able to be understood by our minds.
Well, yeah, it's something and outside of time and space.
We don't try and figure it out. Actually, Maharaji said, stop trying to figure anything else. Don't try and figure it out, okay? And we stop. And at the moment we stop and surrender into the moment, and the Buddhists have so much great terminology about being in the awareness moment, being Trumpas between the gaps, in the gap between the thoughts, rather. We suddenly trust that. And once we trust that, then that perspective that we've been talking about, where we are not judging, we are coming from a place that Ram Dass called loving awareness. We are not judging ourselves. We are not judging other people. We are not trying to change things. We are not trying to have preferences. We are not trying to push shit away that seems... We accept the fact that we are human. We have suffering. We have to... The little me mischief may... He's a sweet guy, actually. We're going to let him do his thing.
Yeah.
And just, you know, just like a little bit of loving will allow it to be less
mostly
pernicious. And we can be a little kinder.
Love it. See, this thing, and I think it's really important to underline what you just said and stick it in your heart. Because it's like the moment that you allow yourself this possibility of there being something more going on, it's really such a wonderful relief. And
big time,
you know, these moments happen in our family where all of a sudden, I don't know, like the other day, we're listening to Enya and Forrest is like really listening to...
Oh, don't make Forrest listen to Enya.
Ah,
come on,
you monster, demon, mischief man! No, give me a break. It was beautiful. My mom used to like
beautiful.
It. You,
I know, I just...
She lives in a castle full of cats. You're going to judge her? She's the coolest, cool as it gets. But like, we're sitting there listening to it. Forrest eating dinner. Aaron's breastfeeding Dune. Everyone's just in the moment. And it's all love. But it's, you know, it's like... Something has come into the room. I don't know what it is. It's so one. It's all, and it's the only place you want to be. You never want to be out of that place. We're all feeling it. No one's going to say it in the moment. No one's going to be like, "Oh, the transcendent has descended upon our house," because it's outside of words.
It's dirty, even that.
Yeah, exactly. Or like when after Ram Dass married Aaron and I. And Krishna Das is playing music and everyone is chanting. Happened. Something came into the room. I don't know what that is. Same thing that came. But when it came into the room then, I remember thinking, well, that's just because I'm at Ram Dass's house. Or I don't know. They know what that is. But I'm not going to mention it because I don't want to mess it up.
Little mischief.
Yeah. Why say it out loud? But then... Now I know a little bit more about what that was that came into the room. And I know it's not limited to Ram Dass's house. I know it's not limited to me being around my family or not being around my family. But also I know I can't make it happen. It doesn't seem to obey my desire for it, you know, which is another thing I love that Ram Dass said, which is if you desire realization, that's just another desire. Like you can't...
But there's intention, and you've been fulfilling the intention for so many years now. That intention is sharing. You absolutely want to share whatever has come to you that feels good or feels like enlightening or anything. All of the stuff, you know? You have that wonderful crystal mind that loves to learn and assimilate stuff, and you have been sharing it on this, well, this is mind-rolling, but on Duncan Trussell Family Hour for years and years. You're the only reason I'm sitting here doing this now with you. No other reason. So you are doing it, and it's that intention that it's, you know, back to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama's most simple, kindness is my only religion.
That's all we got.
And then, so there's nothing to do but share that. And the little mischief guy, Krishnamurti, we got to love him too.
So tell that to Aaron. But he's not... I think I can kind of...
We're going to love him. We're going to learn to love him. That's the purpose. That is the point of this podcast.
I think
learn
if we
to
can
love...
That. I think if we can do that, learn to love this thing. Hmm. And not bullshit love either.
Yeah.
But love it. Honest. Unconditional positive regard the way Carl Rogers loved that kid, or the way that Neem Crowley...
Or Mr. Rogers.
The real
Come
deal.
On.
But, you know, if we all started doing that, my I do think that like we're getting the cart in front of the horse if we think that the way to stopping environmental collapse is through going to war with ourselves. It's just not going to work because we're part of the earth too. And a house divided upon itself cannot stand. So we have to figure out a way to stop the war inside.
Yeah.
And then maybe from that, all the other stuff, maybe.
Absolutely. 1,000,000,000%. And we're going to end this podcast on that note. Stop the war inside ourselves. You know, I did a podcast with a fantastic monk from the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, Trung Lu. And he went on about that very thing. What happened to him is he was with in Plum Village with Thich Nhat Hanh for 17 years or something as a monk. He said, I was the best monk you could ever be, doing everything exactly right. And he said, nothing happened to me. Zero. I didn't change. Nothing. So I dropped my robes. He said, that's when it happened of its own. I was just too much of doing. And he talked about, while I was there as a monk for 17 years, all I had was a war going on inside myself. Yeah. Just what we were just talking about. And then once that left, then suddenly that realization came and that war started to evaporate. And that's what it's all about for all of us, as far as I'm concerned.
You're the best. I'm so lucky we're friends.
I love you. I love you. Best. Never mind. We have a mutual admiration society. Thank you so much, Duncan.
Anytime.
I don't even consider this a podcast. No. I mean, we do this, by the way. I can't tell you how many times we just get on the phone and we're just talking or whatever, and it gets into an extended conversation, and I go, well, this is the same thing as a podcast. We ought to record the damn thing whenever we get on.
When I'm having a great conversation, I'm like, let's monetize this.
Yeah, right. But we're not gonna get into ourselves and go, you cheap piece of shit.
It's how we get our grub. Yeah, it's how we get our grub.
Yes, we lovely little mischief guy. That's what we'll call this, the little mischief.
Little
guy.
Mischief man.
Yeah.
All right, Raghu. Well, thank you for letting me be on the show again.
We'll throw some stuff up, everybody. You know, with show notes and links and Be Here Now Network. It's we is happening. Okay, we'll see you later. Thank you.
Big thank you to Raghu for coming on the show. Check out his podcast, Mind Rolling. All the links you need to find him will be at DuncanTrussell.com. A tremendous thank you to our wonderful sponsors, Mint Mobile, Purple, and of course, Blue Chew. All the offer codes are at DuncanTrussell.com. And a big thank you to you for listening. If you're sick of the commercials, go to patreon.com/DTFH. And again, I am not saying it will protect you from these wild animal attacks. It's one of those can't confirm or deny situations. But check us out, patreon.com/DTFH. And thank you for listening. I love y'all, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.